The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm delighted to welcome you all here to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Stephanie Nadoff, a longtime board member and a passionate supporter of this library. As you know, this library has a mantra, which I know you've all heard. We're dedicated to advancing literacy, guiding learning, and inspiring curiosity. And we do that through our stimulating programming and providing unmatchable and life-changing resources for curious people in Philadelphia and the region and around the world. We serve more than 15 million visitors every year at our 61 locations, and also through that robust website I mentioned, freelibrary.org. So here's my pitch. Many of our most popular and important programs and services, like this author series, are made possible only with the help of people like you. So please think about making a gift. Do it in whatever amount you can manage, and you just do it by going to that website, again, freelibrary.org. Okay, commercial done. And now for the part you've all been waiting for. It is my great pleasure to introduce Walter Isaacson. As some of you know, my husband and I spend a part of each year at our home in Aspen, Colorado, the home of the Aspen Institute, where Walter has been the visionary leader for more than a decade. We are blessed to be fellows of the Institute, where we enjoy the most extraordinary programs with all kinds of people who are doing amazing things. Political officials from around the world, business leaders, great writers, acclaimed artists, transformative scientists, thoughtful jurists, entrepreneurs, and innovators. Walter has an uncanny knack for identifying the best thinkers, and not surprising, these have always included the geniuses who are the innovators. So it was no surprise that his latest book focuses on them and tells the tale of the digital revolution, especially. But you have to remember that this book comes on the heels of his string of engaging and instructive biographies of Benjamin Franklin, Albert Einstein, Henry Kissinger, and of course that breathtaking one in 2011, Steve Jobs. And all of that comes on top of a stunning career, which also includes a long string of leadership roles at Time Magazine, CNN, and Teach for America. So when the New York Times says about his work, quote, "Mr. Isaacson's gift as an enthusiast and explicator are impressive," you can be sure that's not an understatement. In telling the tales about the creators of the computer and the internet age, he is, as they said, a kindred spirit to the visionaries who speed us into the technological future. I know you can't wait to hear about the innovators, so please join me in welcoming Walter Isaacson.
Thank you very much, Stephanie, and thank you very much, Michael, for putting this together, and all of you for being back here. It's so great to be back in Philadelphia. If you've written a book about Benjamin Franklin, you feel like you're a citizen of this town. And it's by having written about the good Ben Franklin that got me interested in this topic. Because as you know, Benjamin Franklin was everything the great innovators of today want to be and sometimes are. He was an entrepreneur. He was an inventor. He was somebody who knew how to make the connection between the humanities and the sciences. He had a great sense of humor. And even as he pulls together the U.S. Postal Service, I think it's sort of a model for Comcast or something, as being able to wire the world and make sure your content goes on that wire. And Ben Franklin did all of that as sort of an information entrepreneur of his century. Having written about him and about Steve Jobs, I heard so much about innovation, too, that I wanted to look at what real innovation looks like. Now, that's a word that has been so overused that I think it's become a bit of a buzzword drained of its meaning. So I decided the best way to approach it was to look at, 15, 16, 17 of the most important innovations that made the digital revolution and look at the real people behind them, who they were and what they did. I started with Ada Lovelace, and I must say I did so partly because of my daughter, who, when she was applying to college, had not really done her admissions essay, and especially her mother, but I'll admit even myself, were the type of hovering parents who believe that you're supposed to help with these essays, and Betsy did not want us to do that. So finally she comes down and said, well, I've written it and I've sent it in. I said, fine, what was it on? And she says, Ada Lovelace. And I go, Ada Lovelace, remind me again. And she said, well, she was the first woman programmer, the person who invents the concept of the general interest computer. And indeed, in the 1830s, Ada Lovelace, who was Lord Byron's daughter, developed a real feel for romantic poetry from her father. But her mother was a mathematician. Her mother was also not particularly fond of Lord Byron by the time Ada was growing up, but that's for a different speaker to explain. And so Lady Byron had Ada tutored mainly in mathematics. And so she developed what Ada called a poetical science, an ability, like so many people here in Philadelphia have, to connect the arts with the sciences, to stand at that intersection of the arts and the sciences. When her mother took her around the Midlands of England to see the mechanical looms that were using punch cards to make beautiful tapestries, Ada was totally mesmerized by it. Her father was a Luddite, and I mean that literally. Lord Byron's only speech in the House of Lords was defending the followers of Ned Ludd, who were smashing these looms. That's where the word Luddite comes from. And he was smashing the looms because he thought, as so many people have thought over the ages, that technology would put people out of work. It's never been true, but people in each age fear that. Lord Byron feared it. He goes off to Switzerland with Mary Shelley, right? Frankenstein's monster, Mary Shelley does. That whole notion that technology will destroy us was very much ingrained into Lord Byron. But Ada Byron, or Ada Byron Lovelace, as she became, really believed that the punch cards were a way to teach machinery to do things that were beautiful, to connect art and machinery. And she had a friend named Charles Babbage who invented a calculating machine, the difference engine, was building another one called the analytical engine that was going to use punch cards to tell the numbers, to do the calculations of the numbers. And Ada came up, wrote and published, which was unusual for a woman in the 1830s, published a paper in a scientific journal on Babbage's analytical engine, and said that the punch cards would allow the machine not only to do numbers, but anything that could be notated symbolically. That means words, she said, pictures, art, even make beautiful pieces of music using the symbolic notation, something that would have made her father flinch. But indeed, that's what the modern computer is, the ability to manipulate any time, any type of symbolic languages, so we can do pictures, music, art, words, as well as numbers. So Ada Lovelace, that becomes her great theory. She even writes the first bit of software for the analytical engine. And to me, the first lesson of the digital age is that notion of connecting the humanities to technology. It's something we see among all the great innovators of the digital age. I remember watching Steve Jobs in every single one of his product launches, from the iPod to the final iPad 2. He always ended with a slide on the screen that said the liberal arts and the sciences, and he says, that's what we stand, that's where we stand at Apple. That's where we stand, those of us who are creating things in the digital revolution, at the intersection of the arts and science. That's where the value is created. Now, Ada Lovelace had only one caveat. She said, machines will be able to do everything except think. They will not be able to originate thought. They won't have imagination. That's up to the humans. The humans will provide the imagination and the originality and the real thinking. 100 years later, almost exactly, Alan Turing comes along. Alan Turing, you'll see a movie about him pretty soon called The Imitation Game, labels that Lady Lovelace's objection, that machines can't think, and he comes up with a test. We call it the Turing test. He called it the imitation game, which was, how would you know a machine can't think? And the way he decides that you would test that is you put a machine and a person in a room somewhere else, and you send in questions. And if after a while you can't tell the difference between the person and the machine, then there's no reason to say the machine's not thinking. That's the Turing test. I don't actually think, and most philosophers would think, well, that's not actually a great test for true human intelligence. But whether or not it is, he said machines would pass it soon. Well, they never really have. Every now and then you'll read a story about some machine sort of passing the Turing test, meaning that for 5 minutes it was able to play a conversational gambit game with somebody and confuse somebody. But nobody's ever confused a machine for a real thinking human being. And that sets up two strands in computer thought, in my mind. What I'll call the Ada Lovelace strand, which says it's a combination of humans and machines that the real value will happen, and the Alan Turing strand that pushes the notion of artificial intelligence and machine learning. And though you will have people on this stage who talk about the singularity in artificial intelligence and how close we are and how machines are going to get along without us, they've been saying that for approximately 60 years. They've always been saying it's about 10, 20 years away, and it's always a receding horizon. But the Ada Lovelace approach of connecting humans to technology, making us more intimate, more personal, has succeeded year after year. And so that's lesson two of the digital age in my mind, is make it personal. That it's yield to the hands-on imperative, as the old hackers would say in Stephen Levy's book, which is that the more personal make it, the more you have a hands-on feeling for it, the more you're going to be able to connect humans to technology and take advantage of both. Alan Turing's machine that he created at Bletchley Park, England, was designed, along with the rest of the team at Bletchley Park, they designed it to break the German wartime codes. And it was an electronic computer, especially the Colossus, that used a whole lot of vacuum tubes and were able to actually break the German codes. And some people say that was the first computer. One of the things I do in my book is explore the notion of who really helped create the first computer. You can make the argument for Colossus at Bletchley Park, but it was a special purpose computer. It was designed simply to break the German codes, and to my mind, the definition of a computer is that it has to be programmable, it has to do, like Ada Lovelace said, or Alan Turing even said, multiple types of things. It has to be electronic, probably has to be digital. That leads us to sort of a contest between two people, two groups, or two places in the United States. One was Iowa State, where John Vincent Atanasoff, a professor of physics at Iowa State, was pretty much a loner. He came up with the notion, though, that you could use electronic circuits to do Boolean algebra, logic, all the things they were doing, Bletchley Park and other things, and make a computer that would calculate that way. And as a loner, he had just one graduate student working with him. He did it in the basement of the physics building at Iowa State. Now, we biographers tend to know deep inside that we distort history a little bit. We tend to romanticize the lone inventor, the person who invented the. And we tend to make it seem like some guy or gal in a garret or garage has a light bulb moment and something gets invented. Those type of historians tend to, I think, over-romanticize Atanasoff. For a couple of reasons, I think they're wrong. First of all, because he was a loner, he never really got the thing to work. You know, he got it so it conceptually it all worked, but he couldn't get the punch card burners to burn punch cards. He didn't have engineers. He didn't have mechanics. So it kind of just half-worked. And then got abandoned when he joined the Navy, and they needed the space in the basement of the physics building for something else, and somebody dismantled it, and they threw it away. And that leads to another lesson of the digital age, which is vision without execution is just hallucination. And that's what Atanasoff shows us. There was, however, another lesson of the digital age, which is that innovation is a team sport. It's a collaborative effort. And that's where you get back to here in Philadelphia, because every one of my books has to have a Philadelphia component. The first real computer was invented here in Philadelphia. And I want to pause for a moment to give a real shout out, if I may, to Bill Mockley. Bill Mockley's father and mother, Kay and John Mockley, were the visionaries who invented the first computer. John Mockley was one of those people who was as collaborative as Atanasoff was a loner. He grew up in Washington, D.C., in the suburbs. His father was in the at the Carnegie Institute, one of those places where scientists gather, people do collaborative science. They were doing weather measurements from Peru to the Arctic. So it meant gathering people and data. And he was of that generation and type of England and the United States that liked to gather in explorers' clubs and wood-paneled rooms and Smithsonians and Carnegie institutions and share research, present papers, and talk about things. So when he, at Ursinus College, and then studying electrical engineering at Penn on a wartime summer course, he wants to build a computer. So what does he do? Like a bumblebee collecting pollen and buzzing around and sort of helping to fertilize ideas, he goes all over the place. He goes to the 1939, and Bill, correct me if I'm wrong, 1939 World's Fair, looks at the machines there, goes up to Dartmouth and finds that Stibitz has created at Bell Labs a certain type of calculating machine using electronics. And he looks at it both because they're doing it from a distance at Dartmouth, where he's working on a teletype. He goes to Bell Labs, goes to Vassar, where they're looking at ways to count like Geiger counters using tubes and a counting function. And then here in Pennsylvania at some meeting, he meets this guy Atanasoff, who happens to be at Philadelphia, at a lecture. Atanasoff says, you know, I'm building one of those in my basement of my physics building in Iowa. And John Mockley gets into his car with his young son, not you, right? No, your brother. Yes. And drives to Iowa 4 days. Because this is a guy who wanted to gather information, and this is the way innovation works in the digital age. People gather information from a variety of places, and John Mockley comes back here having gathered all this information and forms a partnership with a guy named Press Eckert. Presper Eckert, old Philadelphia family, a great engineer. And by the way, that's another lesson of the digital age, is that not only is creativity a collaborative sport, not only is it a team sport, it's also usually a partnership. Whether it's Paul Allen and Bill Gates, or Steve Jobs and Wozniak, or Larry Page and Sergey Brin, it's usually somebody with vision and somebody who knows how to execute. So you've got Mockley and Eckert here. And what they do is not only build a computer, but first they build a team. They build a team of quite a few people at Penn, up to 70 people working on it at one time. It's in a huge room, and they've got mechanics. They've got people with grease under their fingernails. They've got engineers. They have programmers. They have mathematicians and theoreticians. So they can make everything from the punch card burners to the circuits to the vacuum tubes work. And in particular, there's a group of women, PhDs in math, who are called computers, because they're actually computing the missile trajectories, because this is why the machine was originally built, to do missile trajectories for our artillery in World War II. And they tap six of the women who were the mathematicians in this group, to go to a special course at Aberdeen Proving Ground to learn how to do programming, how the machine really works. These women are not that well known in history, but like Ada Lovelace, they were the pioneer programmers, and they deserve much more recognition in history. Partly, it was because back then, in the 1930s, a lot of women got PhDs in math. In fact, more women got PhDs in math by absolute number and by proportion in the 30s than they did in the 50s and the 60s. That was before men told women they couldn't do math. And women were great mathematicians. Grace Hopper, who got a math PhD at Yale, is programming the Mark I at Harvard, and these six women are programming ENIAC in Philadelphia. And the boys with their toys, of course, think the hardware is the big thing. The dirty little secret that they didn't know is that it's eventually the hardware becomes somewhat interchangeable. You don't really care whether it's a Honeywell Unisix or desk computer. You care about the operating system software, and that's what the women were doing back then. And so you have these six women of ENIAC, led by Jean Bartik, Betty Snyder, and of course, the woman who becomes Kay Mockley. And they reprogrammed the ENIAC, and especially since it was done during wartime secrecy, they do a program for the great unveiling of ENIAC, which is on Valentine's Day of 1946, February of 46. It's a big day over at Penn. They unveil the computer. It has all the blinking lights, front page of the New York Times, Mockley and Eckert's pictures in the paper. The women have done a ballistic missile trajectory that works perfectly. And then, after the great unveiling, all the dignitaries and military brass from Washington and all the politicians and Eckert and Mockley go to a great dinner in Houston Hall, candlelit dinner, and the women aren't invited. They take the bus back or the train back to their houses on the main line in Philadelphia, written out of history. It is true, however, that Bill Mockley, we will say, A, began to realize the importance of the women computers, and B, married one of them, which is, and also they became the programmers, not only for ENIAC, but for the UNIVAC, which is the commercial version that came after Mockley and Eckert left Penn. So the women finally do get their due, but I wanted to give them even more due in this book, because I do think one of the many reasons women have not been as involved in the digital revolution recently is because they don't have as many role models. They've been written out of history some. So people like Ada, Grace Hopper, the six women programmers of ENIAC, to me are great role models. And that, to me, too, is another lesson of the digital age. I'll put it in the blunt terms that my daughter did after she wrote that thesis and told me about the ENIAC woman and then decided to major in computer science. And I said, why? And she said, because girls who code get jobs. And I do hope that there will be more in the future like that. But these big old computers were pretty amazing, but they weren't really personal things. In fact, when Mockley and Eckert go off to found UNIVAC, people at IBM and other places saying, there's no reason we need more than, say, six of these computers in the whole world. And the reason partly is that they weren't something you could get your hands on. You had to batch process, it was called. You know, I can still remember doing Fortran processing on punch cards. You turn in your punch cards, and then the next day you get your thing. There wasn't really that intimate feeling I said was the Ada Lovelace hands-on imperative that you have to get personal. It takes the notion of interactive computing to make the next step. And one of the heroes there is a guy named Lick Licklider, J.C.R. Licklider, a humble guy from Missouri who likes giving credit more than taking credit, which is a mark of a great innovator in the digital age. And he is at MIT. He also helps fund Raytheon. He found Raytheon. He also becomes part of what the Pentagon and the Advanced Research Projects Agency. And he, Vannevar Bush, and a lot of these other people at MIT are part of a triangle, I think is what Vannevar Bush called it, of government, corporations, and universities that really are at the forefront. And that was where the basic research was done on everything from the transistor, microchip, computer, laser, internet. And it's something we're losing out today a little bit as we don't have as much basic research, either at the Bell Labs or at the federal level. And I worry that our edge as a country will slip if we don't start paying more attention to doing the basic research that was the seed corn for these great inventions. Anyway, the one that Licklider did was an air defense system. And it had two real components. Batch processing wouldn't really work if you're sitting at a console with an air defense system. You can't put in your punch cards and see Where's that missile coming from and where's it going to go? It had to be instantly interactive, hands-on. So it's really real-time interactive computer, time-sharing, developed at MIT. Secondly, you have graphical user interfaces that are really clear because a console jockey who mistakes one blip for another or doesn't know which way it's going, they've invented video games like Space War, and it helps them figure out, well, let's have the dot with a little tail so we can see which way it's moving. That notion of the graphical user interface comes up. And thirdly, they have 23 of these air defense systems around the country. They've got to network them. Licklider, being kind of a humorous guy, calls it the intergalactic computer network. By the time he gets to the Pentagon, he decides it should be funded for all sorts of research computers. They call it the ARPANET, and it becomes the Internet. These type of people were just deeply creative at what they did. Then there were the people who were able to make these computers truly personal, because when they have big old hot vacuum tubes, they're not going to work. At Bell Labs, you find out another lesson of the digital age, which is that collaboration happens best in person, despite the fact that we can all Skype in and telecommute and, you know, don't need to be there in person. Real creativity happens when people, we were talking about it before, bump into each other in the hallways, finish each other's sentences, sit around in the beanbag chairs of the Google headquarters. Googleplex always beats Google Hangouts. You know, it doesn't work as well online, which is why Marissa Mayer, when she came to Yahoo, told the employees, hey, let's quit telecommuting. It helps when we're all there in person. So in Bell Labs, you have information scientists like Claude Shannon and people who climb telephone poles to amplify phone signals and quantum theorists and experimentalists, and they all working together, bumping each other, sharing a big workspace. And you get a group called the Solid State Group that's trying to figure out how do you get rid of these vacuum tubes and do something that's solid that will do the same thing. And they start doping pieces of semiconducting material, material that doesn't either conduct real well like copper or resist real well like rubber or glass. But if you impurify it a bit, you can make it into, you can change its conducting capabilities, whether it's silicon, germanium, or other products. And they invent the transistor. The leader of the team is Bill Shockley, and he's sort of the anti-hero of the book because even though he's a great theorist, it's really John Bardeen and Walter Bratton, a quantum theorist and an experimentalist, who actually share a workspace and a bench. And like a librettist and a composer making a song, they did sort of a call and response as they figured out what's happening on the surface of the silicon. What if you jabbed a paperclip through it? And we could do, and they did all sorts of amazing things to invent it. But Shockley, unlike Licklider, liked taking credit more than giving credit. And he really horned in on the credit for it because he was the leader of the team. And he starts a company, moves them out to California to make semiconductors. But because he was so paranoid and, as some of you know, became racist and, you know, was he was not able to glue together a team the way Ben Franklin glued together the founders at the Constitutional Convention and made everybody work together. So Shockley Semiconductor explodes. And what you have is, coming out of it, two of the greatest, nicest visionaries of the digital age, Bob Noyce and Gordon Moore, who visualized the whole notion of a semiconductor. But as I said, just being a visionary doesn't count. You got to be able to execute. They bring in Andy Grove, who knows how to execute. And they eventually form Intel, which becomes the archetype of a digital age company. Instead of having a hierarchical system, it's got a big open workspace. There's no authority handing things down. It's all done collaboratively. That, too, is the way the Internet is formed. Because when Licklider goes to the Pentagon and decides we're going to have the ARPANET, they come up with sort of a routers. They call them IMPs, interface message processors. They're going to go in each of these packet switchers, basically, that are going to go in each of these places. But they don't come up with the specifications of how to do it. So the research institutions that are getting these things, they're told, we'll come up with the protocols for how these things are going to talk to each other. And being research institutions, instead of the professors actually doing it, they delegate it to their graduate students. And so a group of graduate students across the country starts hanging out together to write the protocols for how these things are going to work together. And they keep waiting for the people back east, the people from Washington, to come dictate from on high how it's going to be done. But instead, nobody tells them how to do it. And they decide that they don't want to do it in an authoritarian, dictated way. They decide they just want to make it totally a team thing, where nobody's in charge. And one of the guys in charge of just taking the notes wants to make sure that his notes don't become dictatorial in some ways. So standing in the shower one day, he comes up with a name for them. He calls requests for comments. And that's still how the internet is still being developed, is that anybody who wants to create a certain protocol, instead of saying, here's a new way we're going to do things, puts it out on paper and calls it a request for comment. And it's just a way to say, let's all share in the building of this. The fingerprints of that process, I think you can see in the internet today. Because instead of having any centralized hubs, any particular controls, it's all done in a peer-to-peer way. Every node on the internet has equal ability to route and forward and store packets. If one of the nodes gets taken out, the internet just routes around it. It will both survive a nuclear attack, but it will also survive attempts at censorship. All because of this collaborative nature, of, in my mind, of the way the digital age was invented. You see that in every single thing that happens from that point on, from the internet to the personal computer to Google, whatever it may be. For the personal computer, it really does follow that notion of we want to have it hands-on. People thought, up until the 1970s, that computers might be kind of Orwellian, that they're going to be run by corporations, government, the power structure, you know, and that the tools would not be in personal hands. Out in California, in the Bay Area in the early 70s, you see a confluence of tribes almost, a confluence of cultural stew, or cultural gumbo in a way, of different types of people who all share the notion that they want hands-on access to tools. There's the anti-war movement and the free speech movement coming out of Berkeley. There's the hippie movement. There's the electric Kool-Aid acid tests and Ken Kesey, who are doing things like the mother of all demos, where they're demoing computer things. They're the community organizers, and they're people who read the Whole Earth Catalog often, over and over again, and Stuart Brand, and Access to Tools, as well as a whole lot of electronics geeks. And they're the people who say, no, we've got to start taking computers and putting them into the hands of the people. Another element of that is the hobbyists. I was a hobbyist growing up. This is where I got interested in this book. I used to go to the basement, you know, I was a real geek, and solder Heath kits and ham radios and make circuits and sort transistors from resistors. And one of the things I fear about today's age is when I was growing up and the radio didn't work, you know, you'd open the back of the radio and maybe with the help of your dad or your uncle, you'd go figure out which of the tubes was burned out, you know, and you'd test the tubes and you go to the store and buy the right tube. And when that got superseded by transistors, you kind of knew the circuit. You knew exactly. You could visualize, oh, here's how it works. The transistors here, resistor, capacitors. Here's how it works. You didn't have to be a total genius. You just have to have a Heathkit manual and a soldering iron, and you had a fingertip feel for our technology. Now, I feel we're a little bit alienated from our technology. We're not even allowed to open, you know, our computer to change the battery, much less hack in or jack in to the circuit board. So I hope there's some way we will get back to not being so alienated from the way our hardware works. But back then, the hobbyists were deeply in control, and they began creating make-it-yourself computer kits, especially one called the Altair, which was done by the ultimate hobbyist, a guy named Ed Roberts out of Albuquerque, who had made backyard rockets. He was about 45 years old, but he was still a pimply-faced teenager at heart, and was always doing those type of things, you know, model railway switches and prank rockets and things you could do. And finally, he made calculator sets that you could put together on the theory that, you know, if you made your own calculator, it'd be better than buying one. Unfortunately, by the time he was making these calculators, it cost more to buy one of his kits and put it together yourself than it did to go to the corner drugstore and buy one from Japan. So he was going bankrupt really fast. And being a true entrepreneur, he doubles down and convinces Intel to sell him a lot of microprocessors, and he makes his first hobbyist kit of a computer. A couple things happen when the Altair first comes out. First of all, you know, another rule of the digital age is that if a tree falls in the forest and nobody hears it, it doesn't really make a sound. You need the publicity, the product launch. So he has the product launch by convincing the editors of Popular Electronics to put the Altair on the cover. It's on the cover in January 1975, which means it comes out in late December of 74. And Paul Allen, who had dropped out of college because his friend Bill Gates was at Harvard and convinced him to come move to Cambridge, even though Paul Allen wasn't in college there or anything. Paul Allen's wandering through Harvard Square, and at that newsstand at the Harvard Square newsstand, in the middle of the triangle there, he sees Popular Electronics with the world's first personal computer kit. And he goes, this thing is happening without us. Plunks down 75 cents, buys the issue, and trots through the snow to Courier House and shows it to Bill Gates, who is studying for exams. Bill reads the article, starts rocking, skips all of his exams, and for the next 6 weeks, they write BASIC for the Altair. That's how, and Microsoft then, instead of selling BASIC to the company making the Altair, licenses the right to use it, but keeps the property rights to itself. This is another lesson of the digital age, is make good deals. It's all about entrepreneurship. He, of course, replicates that when he pulls the same trick on IBM, doesn't sell them the operating system, just licenses it, and so he gets to keep the operating system. And so there is the Altair with the first piece of personal computing software, BASIC, written by a company called Microsoft, as they named themselves, Paul Allen and Bill Gates. If you look at the first one, it says Paul Allen and Bill Gates doing business as micro-soft is on the first BASIC. They take the BASIC computer, the Altair computer, the company that's making it, on the road, and of course they bring it right up to Silicon Valley with this flowering of the notion of a hands-on personal computers and video games is taking hold. And they bring it to a meeting that includes the Homebrew Computer Club. The Homebrew Computer Club, as you might suspect by their name, is sort of an amalgam of all those people I talked about. You know, hippies and electronic geeks and phone freakers and free speech movement people and community organizers, all meeting to sort of talk geek talk about electronics. They look at this Altair, it really doesn't do much, and they see Bill Gates as Microsoft, and they copy it. They make large numbers of copies of the tape. Bill Gates writes a horrified letter saying, you're stealing my intellectual property. And we see the great tension of the digital age, which is open source software should be free versus intellectual property. It's a wonderful dynamic that I think, as a dynamic, neither side being exactly purely right, helps spur the digital age. Another thing happens, though, which is Steve Wozniak is there. And Steve Wozniak looks at the specs for the Intel 8088, actually, and says, wait a minute, I can make a circuit even better than that. And I can connect it to a monitor and a keyboard. So he does it. And being part of that whole earth catalog commune type, he makes many, many copies of the specs for his circuit board and hands it out for free at the next meeting of the Homebrew Computer Club. At the third meeting, he brings his friend from down the street, Steve Jobs, who then says, wait a minute, let's not hand this out for free. We can go to my parents' garage and we can make these things and sell them. And thus, Apple is born. So out of that little ferment there, you see the birth of both Microsoft and Apple. Anyway, these are the type of collaborative, strange teamworks of both brilliant visionaries we know about, Woz and Jobs and Gates, and people I didn't know about, Licklider, Vannevar Bush, even John Mockley and Prosper Eckert, who go and make up the digital age. To me, before I go to the questions, I'll say one of the main lessons is that Ada Lovelace turns out to be right. that it really is about connecting the humans to the technology, not trying to build machines that will think without us, machines that will work on their own. When you look at any of the great inventions, there's another general rule of the digital revolution, which is the street finds its own uses for things. Anything that gets invented finally gets taken over by us humans to form connections, to communicate, to form communities, to form social networks. That's true of the first personal computers, when we finally get online, finally get on the internet. There's a little bit of a backward move when Tim Berners-Lee creates the World Wide Web. I was at Time Inc. when it happened. And the World Wide Web doesn't become a community or connectivity medium. It sort of becomes a publishing medium where people can publish their own things on it. And the community, which used to be very vibrant on the Well or even on AOL, gets relegated to comments. But once again, people come along like Justin Hall and start making weblogs that become known as blogs. And suddenly, community takes over again. And finally, even if you look at Google, and people say, well, you say machines can't think without us. What about Google? Google can answer any question better than a machine. First of all, Google can't quite. You can ask Google a very tough question, like how deep is the Red Sea? And more than any friend you know, it'll be very smart and say 5,780 feet or whatever it is. But you ask it a simple question like, you know, can a crocodile play basketball? And it has no clue, you know. And a four-year-old can answer you that after giggling a bit. Likewise, you go to the Total Domain Awareness System in the foot of Manhattan, and you see all these cameras that can sort of look at all the crowds at Grand Central, but it still can't spot a mother, your mother's face or whatever, something a four-year-old can do. All the way through, you see that things that our minds can do are hard for computers to do, and things that are hard for our minds to do are very easy for computers to do. The combination of the two works well together. And that's what happens with Google, even. It's not like Google is actually finding out the depth of the Red Sea or whatever it may be. Google simply is a crawler that harvests the millions and billions of human judgments made every month by people who create websites and put web links on their websites. They will create a link, they will say something, you know, in response to a little thing, and Google simply harvests all those links and makes a combination of human judgments and computer algorithms. So when people tell you that someday the singularity will happen, someday machines will think without us, you can say what old Licklider said, yep, maybe someday, but in the meantime, let's make our machines more personal. Let's connect humans to machines more intimately, whether it's the Apple Watch or Google Glass or your iPhone or iPad or iPod or laptop computer. That notion of making it personal and making it simple is the key to the digital age. And if we're going to connect our humans to technology, we have to remember what Ada Lovelace knew and what this city knows so well, which is the connection of the arts and the sciences, the humanities and technology. We talk about STEM education a lot, and it's very important that we learn engineering and math and technology, but it's also important that we learn what do we humans bring into this party, and that's imagination, creativity, moral judgments, intentionalities, and that's what the humanities teach us. That's what the arts teach us. So we shouldn't forget those. We also shouldn't forget those of us who love the humanities and the arts. I sometimes say that and people, you know, yes, you're so right. We need the arts and the humanities. But people in the arts and the humanities should realize they should be a bit more like Ada Lovelace, which is understand, too, the beauty of math and the beauty of science. I know a lot of people who love the arts and the humanities and would be absolutely appalled if you said you didn't know the difference between a Picasso and a Miro, or didn't know the difference between Hamlet and Macbeth. But they would be perfectly proud, might even brag, that they don't know the difference between an integral or a differential equation, or the difference between a transistor and a capacitor, or a gene and a chromosome. And what Ada understood was that a piece of her father's poetry was absolutely beautiful. You could visualize it. She walks in beauty like the night, perfectly wonderful and beautiful. But so too are math, engineering, science, even circuit boards, even that notion of doping the semiconducting material. I try in this book to make those things human too, to show that they're real humans who really figured out how do the electrons dance on the surface of a semiconductor, how would you make an impurity that made them dance differently, and maybe if we who are in the arts and the humanities had a little bit more appreciation for the scientists and mathematicians who figured these things out, we wouldn't feel quite as intimidated or even quite as alienated from our technology. Because I do think that the future of the revolution belongs to those, from Ada Lovelace to Steve Jobs, who can stand at the intersection of the humanities and technology and marvel at the beauty and the wonder of each. Thank you all very much. As you know, there are questions. I think those are the mic runners. And you all run mics or they run to you? The mics go to Mohammed in this town. Okay. Hand there. The gentleman in that sweater, the gentleman there. I'm going to have to pick on more than just gentlemen, but I will get to you, sir.
Differing from the old days where technology produced more jobs after a period of downside will not produce the jobs in the next cycle or
Correct.
Two cycles. Would you care to comment on
that? Yeah, and I've read The Economist, and they do actually talk about both sides of it. That is the deep question of our time. That is the Lord Byron question. Does the mechanical loom put more people out of work? All of our data points in history show that people worry that technology will destroy jobs, but in the end, technology increases productivity and ends up creating jobs, whether it's the industrial revolution, scientific revolution, whatever. And your question and the economist's question is, for the first time in history, is it different? Is it different this time? We had a debate, and I want to thank Stephanie for her shout-out for the Aspen Institute, this summer, not a real debate, but a discussion on that issue at the Aspen Institute with Penny Pritzker, the Commerce Secretary, taking the side, no, that just, you know, the more productive an economy is, the more jobs it can create, and we just don't know how. And Larry Summers sort of arguing that maybe this time it's different. Not only that there'd be fewer jobs, but here's a more a different way of that question, which is, even if there are not fewer jobs, it'll hollow out the middle, and we'll have more economic inequality. The reason I'm waffling here is I do not know the answer, nor did Larry, nor did Penny Pritzker. My gut instinct is that technology is only as good or as bad as we use it. We have no idea what technologies will spring upon us. 5 years ago, you wouldn't have predicted Uber cars. Now, I'm not saying Uber is the world's greatest job creator. You don't even have it in Philadelphia yet. But, I mean, that notion of disrupting industries, we don't know. Even if you look at technology, whether you like it or not, I'm from Louisiana, I kind of like it, technology is fracking. I mean, horizontal drilling and unconventional extraction of tight gas. This is a technological revolution. And it's just hard to know what will that do to the economy in the future and what will they think of next. My worry is not that technology will go so fast it'll hurt jobs. It's that somehow our country will quit innovating as fast as it does. It'll get itself overregulated. It'll have a K-12 system that's no longer the best in the world, which has already happened. It will have an economic divide. And those things will slow technological innovation. And to me, that's a greater fear than technological innovation being unable to create a more productive economy. But come back in 10 years and we'll know. And I do worry about that question, but I think we'll be okay. Yes, sir.
You're a biographer and a historian. Well, how does technology help you do your research? Does it make it easier? Does it make it more difficult? For instance, people are using emails today. So you have, it seems to me you would have a lot less original material to look at. So
yeah, that's a really good question. There's about five or six layers to that question, one of which is I do worry about the fact that when I did Benjamin Franklin, There's 41 volumes of his letters out. He wrote maybe 20 letters a day, and I know everything he did every minute. With Steve Jobs, he had lost all of his emails. He never wrote letters. We don't preserve emails. We were talking about the library here today. If I were running a library, one thing I would do is gather every tweet and every snap, every Instagram and every blog posting and whatever, because those will be historical, you know, useful in the future, and people's emails. Instead of saying, I want John Updike to donate his papers or Bill Gates to donate his papers, let's say, let's preserve those emails. A second thing that's happened is everything is now digital. I must say there's an upside and a downside to that. I loved going to the Sterling Library at Yale and touching and feeling Benjamin Franklin's letters. Halfway through that project and halfway through Einstein, both of those archives became totally digital, and I could just sit at home and read everything they did, which was fine, except for I lost a little something not hanging around with the archivists doing it. A third thing is on this book, I use the internet. I talked about tonight how the internet is a collaboratively created and collaboratively tilted technology, let me say. When I was writing that, I said, well, why don't I try to use it that way? So I took rough drafts of various of my chapters and put them on Wikipedia-like sites where people could fix them, change them, comment, correct, put things in. And in 1 week, I got 18,000 comments just on the one involving that cultural brew I told you about in California. Stuart Brand himself put up some of his documents and corrected some things about the demise of the Whole Earth Catalog Party. So did Liza Loop, who was one of the community organizers. So did Dan Bricklin, who invented VisiCalc. All of that is in the book because I crowdsourced it. So it's making major changes in how we do books. As always, I think it's 80% for the better and 20% for the worse. That goes to the jobs question. It goes to the research question. I tend to be an optimist, but then again, I admire my friend Bob Caro, who still writes on an Olivetti. Yes, sir.
So tell us, did Al Gore really invent the internet?
I always get that joke at everything. Somebody's got to make it. And there is a section on Al Gore in the book, on the internet. And, you know, here's what's important about the internet, is that it was a research network, ARPANET, and then NSFNet, the Science Foundation, and then the Internet work, which is why it becomes the internet. And in 1991 and 92, the Gore Act both creates the research centers that create Mosaic and the web browsers, but also do the most important thing, which is open the internet to ordinary people. I know in 1992, I vividly remember, I was doing digital media for Time Inc. We were on AOL and CompuServe, but a normal person could not get on the internet. You could do it from University of Pennsylvania. They used to be called the September Flood, where freshmen would go to the university, they'd suddenly be on the internet, and they would go on all the newsgroup boards and say really stupid things, and by October they would have learned netiquette, as it was called, and they'd be normal. What Al Gore does is what's called the Endless September, because in September of 92, the internet opens up, so anybody, you can dial into it from AOL or CompuServe or your own Bell AT&T service, whatever it may be. And that transforms things. It does cause people quite to be upset. The old line internet types, oh my God, the unwashed heathens have arrived at the gates. But to me, one of the things about the digital age is it empowers the individual citizen. It's democratizing. It is why we're very comfortable in a city like Philadelphia, where Thomas Paine handed out pamphlets on the street corner with the free flow of information. And in China, they aren't quite as comfortable. And so, you know, without just joking, I do make a joke or so about Al Gore, but without making the joke about it, there was an important period in the early 90s where we as a nation and our government, in a totally bipartisan way, because the Gore Act was done, you know, totally bipartisan, said, let's take this infrastructure that was built and make sure that we allow anybody, without government control, to say what they want, wherever they want, send information where they want, and have no government control over what goes through the internet. And to me, it's not quite the same as whatever he said he did. He was there at the inception of the, whatever he said, he didn't say invent, but he said something. He probably misspoke, as many of us do on Wolf Blitzer's show, but we shouldn't minimize the fact that that was an important move in 1992. Is there, if I may get a woman, just simply because I was trying to tout the role of women in technology. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be gender biased, but... Yeah,
I was just going to follow that question about what started and what opened the internet to the world, and now we're talking about net neutrality and the possibility that whole open source, openness and freedom of the internet is about to be closed down by corporations because they have the money to do so. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, well, I'm not in the town of Comcast. I don't want to knock all corporations to control. I do believe totally in net neutrality. I think you should read, I'll give Penny Pritzker her second shout out tonight, her speech she gave to ICANN, the Internet, whatever, Council on Assigned Names, day before yesterday, which was fighting for the openness of the Internet, both against possibility of corporate balkanization here or government balkanization around the world. I obviously believe in net neutrality. I think that the whole point, as I just said, of 1992 and the endless September was anybody who wants to can put anything up and nobody gets favored treatment on the Internet. That said, I don't, maybe it's my small libertarian streak, I don't think it's best done simply by government regulation. I think having lots of competition, lots of pipelines, lots of pathways to the Internet is probably the best way, because even if you regulate and enforce net neutrality, say on Comcast now, you don't know that, you know, the next Twitter might be invented or the next Snapchat, and you'll say, well, how does that fit into the rule we just wrote or whatever? So I think the more you have competing ways to get on the Internet, the more you have competing companies, the safer we will be that nobody will singly control it.
I'm dealing with trying to wrestle with the concept of innovation itself.
Yeah.
You seem to be saying that it arrives, a thought process that arrives from a collaborative effort leading necessarily to a practical use for humanity. But where is the concept of innovation for the singular great mind who does it all by him or herself, Einstein being my paradigm example? Is that not a greater view of innovation?
Einstein is the great example, padding around in his loft as a member of the Prussian Academy, Jewish in Germany between the wars, which is not exactly a recipe for having a lot of, you know, collegiality. And I've been asked this question a lot. It's a good one. And I try to think, okay, give me some more examples here. Bach. I think in the arts, the singular innovator's there. Beethoven, Bach, Leonardo, Michelangelo. The digital age seems to me more collaborative, even as Steve Jobs. So Steve Jobs, he comes the closest, right? The absolutely singular man. But I asked Steve right before he died, what product are you most proud of? And I thought he'd say the iPod or the iPhone or whatever. And he'd say, no, creating a product is hard, but what's really hard is creating a team that will continue to create good products. The best thing I ever created was Apple, because it's a team of very loyal people. And even though he was a bit of a, whatever the word might be, he developed a very loyal team around him, a very collaborative team. So I do think, just as I said, vision without execution is, you know, hallucination. Execution without vision is barren. So you do need the visionary. And I'm not denying the role of the great visionary. But Adam Nassauf was a great visionary, but he never could execute. And I don't think I can find in my book or starting in 1940 in the digital age, whether it's Turing, who needs Tommy Flowers and the people who know how to do vacuum tubes, or Shockley, who needs Bardeen and Bratton, anybody who had a great concept who then didn't form a team and say, let's execute it. Ma'am, you get the last question. How do we teach our young children to be innovators? Which ties into the question a lot of people ask me too is, why does a lot more of it seem to happen here in the United States? I think it's partly because we do allow the questioning of authority. It goes back to Thomas Paine being able to publish his pamphlets on this Market Street. with Ben Franklin's printing press. I think it comes because we do allow imagination. I mean, Einstein runs away from the school system in Germany because he has to learn by rote and wants to visualize things. And, you know, like all people I've written about, by the way, this is why I never get asked to speak at graduations. Every single one of them was a dropout, you know. Yeah. Including Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and Ben Franklin and Albert Einstein and even to some extent Henry Kissinger, though after the war he goes back and gets his degree. So I do think having a rebellious streak or the ability, as Steve Jobs said, to think different helps. I think we tolerate failure in America better, especially in the entrepreneurial industries. Unfortunately, we do not tolerate it in government now. Any tiny little thing you do wrong, and I'm not defending government doing things wrong, suddenly becomes, you know, fodder for endless hours of cable TV yelling at you. And so people don't take risks anymore. They, you know, we have a transportation system that's based on anything I can do to avoid any risks, so nobody will blame me for anything. Whereas if you felt that way, you never would have invented the microchip, you know, because, you know, the people, including Andy Grove, said, no, we can't stop making transistors to make this microchip. It may not work. And Bob Noyce said, yeah, but it may. And, you know, so you need to be entrepreneurial and take risks. But to get to the side I'm worried about, and I don't want to end on a pessimistic note, but one reason we've had the best innovation is we have had the best K-12 education system for 100 years. Take Jing Jennings, who we talked about, your mom's partner in programming ENIAC. From Atlantis Grove, Missouri, I think the 7th out of 8 children, a girl who decided she wanted to study math, she gets to go to Missouri State College, you know, Northwest Missouri College, I guess it is, for $78 a year and becomes a mathematician and does the final programming for ENIAC. Northwestern State Missouri College still exists, is now $14,000 a year. People come out saddled with debt. They can't go. If you go to St. Louis, you have a two-tiered school system for rich kids and poor kids. You also have a school system that may be 20th best in the world. Those type of things are things I think we need to worry about. We need to teach our kids to be imaginative, but we also need to teach our kids. And if anything, the seed corn is education. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.